You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. I'm calling this Lecture 13. It is, in fact, answers to questions given to Steiner during the course of the cycle. It is the last part of the book. Answers to questions from the discussion held, first of all, on 1st January 1922. Rudolf Steiner. As a number of questions have been handed in, perhaps it would be best if I began this meeting by trying to answer some of them. If there should be other matters you wish to be discussed, we could meet at another time during this conference. Regarding the first question, it is certainly possible to believe that spreading one main lesson subject over a long period of time could have its drawbacks. Neither can one deny that it is difficult to engage the attention of children on one and the same subject for a longer time. Other opinions, representing official contemporary educational theory, also seem to speak against such an extension of one subject into block periods. Nevertheless, it was decided to introduce this method in the Waldorf School. The point is that the results of recent experimentally based psychological research, which is chiefly responsible for the disapproval of our methods, do not represent the real nature of the human being. These methods do not penetrate the deeper layers of the human being. Why are psychological experiments carried out at all? I do not object to them, inasmuch as they are justified in their proper sphere. Within certain limits, I am quite willing to recognize their justification. Nevertheless, the question remains, why are experiments made with the human psyche in our present times? The answer is that we experiment with the human soul because during the course of human evolution, we have reached a point where we are no longer able to build a bridge, spontaneously and naturally, from one soul to another. We no longer have a natural feeling for the various needs of the child, of how or when it feels fatigued, and so on. This is the reason why we try to acquire, by external means, the kind of knowledge which human beings once possessed in their full presence of mind, linking one soul to the other. We ask, in what way does a child feel fatigued after having occupied him or herself with one or another subject for a certain length of time? We compile statistics, and so on. As I said, in a way we have invented these procedures in order to find out in a roundabout way what we no longer can recognize directly in a human being. But for those who wish to establish a close rapport between the soul of a teacher and that of a child, something else is of far greater importance than questions such as whether too much claim is made upon the pupil's powers of concentration if one teaches the same subject for a longer period of time. If I understand the question rightly, it seems to imply that if one were to introduce a greater variety into the lesson, by changing the subject after a comparatively short time, that then something valuable would be gained. Well, something would be gained, certainly. One cannot deny that. But these things affect the pupil's whole lives, and they should not be calculated mathematically. One ought to be able to decide intuitively whether what has been gained in this way is of greater value when seen against the whole life development of an individual, or whether something has been lost in the long run. It is an entirely different matter whether one teaches the same subject for 2 hours, as in a main lesson, or whether one teaches one subject for an hour and then another subject for the second hour, or even to change subjects after shorter periods of time. Although pupils will tire to a certain extent, a factor for which the teacher has to make due allowance, it is better for their overall development if one proceeds in this concentrated way, than if one artificially limits the lesson time in order to fill the pupils' souls with new and different content in a following lesson. What we consider to be of utmost importance in the Waldorf School is that the teachers make use of their available lesson time in the most economical way, that they apply soul economy with regard to their pupils' potential. If one builds up the lessons along major lines of content which pupils are able to follow without becoming tired, or at least without feeling overcome by tiredness, and if one can work against any oncoming tiredness by introducing variations of the main theme, one can achieve more than by following other methods for the sake of advantages these may possibly bring. In theory, it is always possible to argue for and against such things, but it is not a question of preference for one or the other of them. The only thing that matters is the question, what is best for the overall development of the child, as seen from a long-term viewpoint? There is one further point to be considered. It is quite correct to say that a child will tire if made to listen to the same subject too long. But nowadays there is so little insight into what is healthy or unhealthy for a child, that one looks upon the child becoming tired merely as something negative, something to be corrected. In itself, to become tired is as healthy as feeling refreshed. Life has its rhythms. It is not a question of holding the pupil's attention for half an hour and then to give them some 5 minutes' break to recover from the strain, which in any case would not balance out their fatigue, before cramming something different into their heads. It is an illusion to think that such a method would solve the problem. In reality, one has not tackled it at all. One has simply poured something different into the child's soul instead of allowing the consequences of the organically based causes of tiredness to fade away. In short, one has to probe into the deeper layers of the human soul in order to realize that a longer concentration upon the same subject is of great value for the overall development of a child. As I said, it is easily possible to reach the opinion that quicker changes of subjects offer an advantage. But one must also realize that a perfect solution will never be found in life as it is. The real question is, what is, relatively speaking, the best solution of a problem? And then one will find that short lessons of different subjects do not offer the possibility of giving the children content which will unite deeply enough with their spiritual, their soul, and their physical organizations. Perhaps I should add that if a school founded on the principles I have been describing were ever condemned to put up with boring teachers, one would certainly be forced to cut down the length of the lesson time. I have to admit that if teachers were to give boring and monotonous lessons, it would be better to reduce the length of each lesson. But if teachers are able to stimulate their pupils' interest, the longer main lesson is definitely the better one. For me, the essential point is never to become fixed or fanatical in any way, but always to consider the circumstances. Certainly, if one expects interesting lessons to be given at school, one must not engage boring teachers on the staff. Question 2. There may be justifiable reasons for looking upon eurythmy as a conversion of one art form into another, rather than considering it as a new form of art. But whenever one deals with an artistic medium or with the artistic side of life, it is not the, in quotes, what that matters, but the how. In my opinion, there is no real meaning in the statement that sculpture, music, speech, rhythm, and so on are only the means of expression, while the underlying ideas are the real substance. There seems little point in making such abstract discriminations when one is dealing with life itself. Naturally, if one is keen on finding unifying ideas in the abstract, one can also find different media through which these are expressed. But in real life, these modes or media do represent something new, something different. To give an example, according to Goethe's theory of plant metamorphosis, a colored flower petal, when seen in the abstract, is inherently the same as a green plant leaf. Goethe sees in the flower petal a metamorphosed green leaf. And yet from a practical point of view, a petal is something altogether different from a leaf. Whether eurythmy is a new form of expression or a conversion of one art form into another is not the point at all. What matters is this. During the course of human evolution, speech, and also singing, though the latter is less noticeable, sound, speech, and singing have become more and more a means of expressing what works through the human head. Again, this is putting it rather radically, but from a certain point of view it does represent the truth. Today, human language, human speech, is no longer expressive of the whole human being. Speech has become thought-oriented. Among modern nations, it has become closely linked to the life of thought, and through this development, speech reveals what springs from man's egoism. Eurythmy, on the other hand, goes back again to man's will nature, and by doing so, it engages the whole human being. Through eurythmy, man is revealed as standing within the entire macrocosm. And while, for example, during certain primeval times, gesture and miming always accompanied the spoken word, especially during artistic activities, so that word and gesture combined into a single form of expression, and the two became inseparable, today word and gesture have fallen far apart. Therefore, a need is felt to engage the whole human being again by calling into play also what belongs more to his will sphere, and in this way to relate him again to the macrocosm. Altogether, there seems to be too much theorizing going on these days, whereas it is so important to consider the practical aspects of life, especially in our present time. Anyone observing life from this point of view, without prejudice, knows that for every yes, there is a no, and that everything can be proved both right and wrong. Yet the ultimate value does not lie in proving something right or in refuting it, in finding definitions and in making distinctions, but in what leads to new impulses and to new life in the world. You may well have your own thoughts when hearing all this, ladies and gentlemen, but anthroposophical research does give insight into the development of mankind, and mankind today has a leaning toward overcoming the intellectualistic element, to feel drawn more to what belongs to the soul of man and to life, which produces creative activities rather than definitions. And so it does not really matter whether one looks upon eurythmy as a conversion of one art form into another, or whether one calls it a new art. A little anecdote may illustrate what I mean. When I studied at Vienna University, some of the professors there had been given a much coveted title of distinction. They were called privy counselors, in German Hofrat. In Germany, I found that such professors received the title confidential counselors, Geheimrat. In certain quarters, the distinction between these two titles seemed to be of importance. As for me, what mattered was the personality behind the title rather than the title itself. This seems similar, forgive me, for I really do not wish to offend anybody, to the situation where people engage in philosophical arguments in order to define the difference or to discriminate between transferring one art form into a different medium or, for want of a better word, to call it a new dimension in the realm of art. To question 3. I am not quite clear what this question is meant to convey, but to me it seems to express a somewhat evangelical attitude of mind. At best, discipline, as I have already said, can become a natural byproduct of the ordinary life in the classroom. I have also told you how during the last 2 years of the existence of the Waldorf School, discipline has improved in quite a remarkable way, and I have quoted substantiating symptoms. With regard to this, quote, sense of sin, close quote, footnote here, Rudolf Steiner used these English words, end of footnote. Again, with regard to this sense of sin, it would appear that because of one's own moral attitude, one believed in awakening such a feeling in the child for its own benefit. But, please, let us look at this point free from any religious prejudice. An awakening of such an awareness of sin would pour something into the soul of the child, which would remain there in the form of a certain insecurity for the rest of its life. Putting it into psychoanalytical terminology, one could say that such a method could create a kind of vacuum, an inner emptiness within the soul of the child, which in later life would degenerate into a weakness as compared with a more active and energetic response to life in general. If I have understood the question rightly, this is all I can say in answering it. Question 4. In my opinion, this question has already been answered by what I said during the first part of my lecture this morning. Generally speaking, one cannot say that at this particular age, boys have to go through yet another crisis apart from the one described this morning. There would be too many different grades of development if one were to speak of an emerging turbulence affecting all boys of this age. Perhaps some people are under delusions in this respect. For if the inner change of which I spoke this morning is not guided in the right way by the teachers and educators, then children, and not only the boys but also the girls, can become very turbulent. They become restless and inwardly unwilling, so that it becomes really difficult to cope with them. What happens at this age can vary a great deal according to the temperament of the adolescent, a factor which needs to be taken into account. If this were done, one would not make a generalization of the kind which appears here in the first sentence. It would be more correct to state that unless children are guided in their development, unless the teacher knows how to handle this marked change between the 9th and 10th year, they will become unwilling, unstable, and so on. And only then the situation will arise which has been mentioned in the question. It is essential for the teacher and educator to give full consideration to this turning point in the development of the child. To question 5. What has been written here is perfectly correct, and I believe that no more need be said about it than yes. Of course, one will need a certain tact when talking to pupils between the age of 10 and 12 about the human being. If a teacher is heedful of how much he can tell his pupils about the nature of the human being, then I certainly agree that one has to enter into the individual life of the personality concerned. Question 6. With regard to this question, I should like to say that one must reckon with the possibility of an ever-increasing interest in the development of new methods for penetrating the secrets of human nature. For spiritual research into the human being is a more penetrating one than that of natural science. Of course, the possibilities of this study will not be available in every field, but where they do exist, they should be made use of. It is of benefit not only for teachers and educators to learn how to observe the human being beyond what the outer appearances can tell us, but also, for example, for doctors. I think that one could safely say, without causing any misunderstandings, that only prejudice will stand in the way of such methods, and that their development is desirable. It really is so that much more could be achieved in this direction, if old or intellect-bound prejudices would not bar the way to higher knowledge. These paths, in their initial stages only, have been described in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. Reader's Aside, also known as Knowing Higher Worlds. End of Reader's Aside. To question 7. In the Waldorf School, mathematics definitely belongs to the main lesson subjects, and as such it plays its proper part according to the pupil's various ages and stages. In no way is this subject relegated to lessons outside the main lesson. This question rests on a misunderstanding. Now, answers from Dr. Steiner from the discussion of 3rd January 1922. It begins with Rudolf Steiner. A wish has been expressed that because of the impending departure of various conference members, the practical application of Waldorf principles should be discussed first. In this case, it is surely appropriate for me to speak about the Waldorf School. Nevertheless, I wish to broaden the subject, because I believe that a great deal of strength and real enthusiasm in face of the present world situation are necessary, before our educational aims can be put into practice. It seems to me that only if one can recognize the necessity to move toward the educational impulses described here will it be possible to achieve anything in the nature of a breakthrough in education. I am convinced that anyone willing to observe, without prejudice, the recent development of mankind cannot but realize that we are living in the midst of a cultural decline, and that all objections against such a judgment are based on illusions. Of course, it is not very pleasant, and looks pessimistic, though in reality it is meant to be optimistic, if one speaks in the way I am speaking now. But there are so many symptoms of a declining culture in evidence today that the situation is really quite clear. And only if this is fully recognized does the whole question of education rise up in heart and soul in the right way. In view of this, I can look upon the founding of the Waldorf School only as a first example of the practical application of the education we have been talking about. How did the Waldorf School come about? It owes its existence, and that much can surely be said, to the realization of educational principles based on true knowledge of man. But what made it happen? The Waldorf School is the indirect result of a total collapse of society, which occurred all over Middle Europe in the year 1919. This general collapse embraced all spheres of society, the economical, the social, political, and the spiritual life of all people. Perhaps one could also call it a collapse of the economical and political life and complete bankruptcy of the spiritual life. In 1919, the stark realities of the situation made the entire public only too aware of this fact. Roughly speaking, halfway through the year 1919, there existed a general and complete consciousness of it. Today there is a lot of talking going on, also in Middle Europe, about how mankind will recover again, of how eventually it will pull itself out of the trough again, and so on. Such talk is the figment of an all too comfortable way of thinking, and in reality such thoughts are nothing but empty phrases. The truth is that the decline is bound to accelerate. Today the situation in Middle Europe is not unlike that of a person who has known better days, in which he bought himself plenty of good clothes. He has these clothes now and wears them out to their last shred. The fact that he cannot buy any more new ones is patently clear. Although he knows that he is unable to replenish his stock, he lives under the illusion that all is well, and that he is adequately provided for. In a similar way, the world at large fails to realize that it is no longer possible to obtain new clothes out of its cultural past. During the first half of 1919, the people of Germany were ready for a serious reassessment of the general situation. This, however, was not yet the time of the founding of the Waldorf School, but it was the time when I gave social pedagogical lectures, which contained, though only in sketchy outline, what I have been telling you during this conference. Some people saw sense in it, and this is what led to the founding of the Waldorf School. I emphasize this point because the precondition for a renewal of education is an inner readiness and openness to size up the real situation, which in itself will indicate clearly what needs to be done. At the founding of the Waldorf School, I said, it is good to have such a school to serve as a model, but in itself it is not enough. For as the only school of its kind, it cannot solve the educational problems of our times. Only if during the next 3 months at least a dozen Waldorf schools will have been founded will the first steps have been taken toward a solution in this field. However, since this did not happen, we can hardly look upon what has been achieved in Stuttgart as representing a success. We have but a model, and even this model is not yet representative of what one would wish to see. I will give you an example. Apart from our Eurythmy room, which at long last we managed to get, we also badly need a gym hall. We still are without one, and therefore anyone who visits the Waldorf School must not look at it in its present state as the realization of our aims. Above all the other problems, The school has always been short of money. Let me read that again. Above all the other problems, the school has always been short of money. Financially, it stands on extremely weak and shaky legs. Now, in my opinion, two things need to be done. First, the principles of this education, based as they are on a true picture of the human being, should be made widely known, and the underlying ideas need to be thoroughly taken hold of. Everything possible should be done in this direction. You see, throwing sand into one's eyes leads nowhere in dealing with such serious matters. Therefore, I must ask you to allow me to speak freely and frankly. Often I am told when talking about these things, and also when my views on money are being discussed, quote, well, in England one would have to proceed in quite a different way, or one would merely put people off, close quote. If we were to leave it at that, there would be little progress. Unless we decide to overcome certain objections, we shan't be able to go forward at all. For instance, people say, quote, in England, practical results have to be seen, close quote. This is precisely what the civilized world has been saying during the last 500 to 600 years. Only what people could see with their own eyes was considered to be of real value. This is what drags us down. And if we insist on this stance, we shall never be able to pull ourselves out of this chaos. We are not talking here about small and insignificant matters. What is really necessary is that we take our courage in hand in order to give a new impulse. So often, well-meaning people believe that I do not appreciate what they are saying when they point out to me, quote, in England one would have to do things differently, close quote. I understand this only too well. But this does not get to the root of the matter at all. If the catastrophic conditions in 1919 had not hit the people of Central Europe so hard, though this ill fortune was really a stroke of good luck, as far as the founding of the Waldorf School is concerned, if the terrible situation had not opened their eyes, there would be no Waldorf School in Central Europe, even to this day. For in Central Europe, and especially so in Germany, there is every need for a new impulse because of an innate lack of the ability to organize, because there is so little sense for a structured social organization. If people outside Middle Europe talk so much about German organization, they talk about something which does not reflect the actual facts. There is no outspoken talent for organization in Germany. Above all, there exists no articulated social organism. Instead, the real living culture is carried by single individuals and not by the general public. Look, for instance, at the German universities. These are not in the least representative of the real character of the German people. They are quite abstract formations and not at all an expression of what is truly German. The real German spirit lives only in single individualities. This is, of course, only a hint, but at the same time it also goes to show what is likely to happen if one appeals to a national mood in Germany. One meets a nothingness. One meets only a lack of understanding for the things we have been talking about here. With other words, the Waldorf School owes its existence to an unlucky stroke of luck. And now, with regard to the second point, what matters most, apart from the necessity to build further upon what was spoken of here, is that something like a Waldorf school should be founded also in countries where the population was not jolted into action by abysmal and cataclysmic conditions, such as were experienced in Germany in 1919. If, for instance, a kind of Waldorf school could be opened in England, this would mark a mighty step forward. Naturally, such a school would have to be adapted to the conditions and cultural background of that country. When I realized that the Waldorf School movement was not going to spread its wings, because the original Waldorf School had, in fact, remained the only one of its kind, I tried to initiate a worldwide movement for Waldorf schools, a, quote, Waldorf School movement, close quote. I did so because during the preceding years, there had been a very great expansion of the anthroposophical movement, at least in Middle Europe. Today, the anthroposophical movement is a factor to be reckoned with in Middle Europe. As a spiritual movement, it has made its mark. but there is no organization to direct and guide this movement. The Anthroposophical Society, this needs to be said, for it is right if this is generally known, the Anthroposophical Society is not in the position to carry the Anthroposophical movement. For the Anthroposophical Society is so riddled with the tendency towards sectarianism that it is not capable of carrying the Anthroposophical movement as it is today and as it has developed. All the same, I wanted to make one last appeal to the stronger elements within the Anthroposophical Society, because I was hoping that some individuals might respond by making a final effort to bring about a Waldorf school movement. Well, it did not happen. The world school movement is dead and buried, for it is not good enough merely to talk about such a thing. It needs to be carried out in a down-to-earth and practical way. To implement such a plan, a larger body of people is needed. The Waldorf school in Stuttgart is one of the results of the German Revolution. Itself, it is not a revolutionary school, but the revolution was its matrix, as it were. If something like a Waldorf school could be founded also in another country, say in England, because the general world situation was clearly recognized, this would mean a big step forward. Perhaps later, when time has been given to the discussion, a little more could be said about it. Millicent Mackenzie, professor at University College, Cardiff, a shortened translation by George Kaufman Adams. Professor Mackenzie wishes to say to this point that among the members of this conference, there are several personalities from England present who, recognizing the needs of mankind, would be in a position to work in this direction and who would exert considerable influence in an effort to bring about the realization of this educational impulse. As a first step, they would like to invite Dr. Steiner to England sometime during this year, and they are eager to create the right mood and setting for this visit, during which they hope a number of prominent personalities and educators would also be present to welcome Dr. Steiner. Rudolf Steiner. I wish to add that such a step must be taken only in a practical sense, and that it would be harmful if one were to talk too much about it. Those among you who are in a position to take a step forward in this direction would have to prepare the ground so that, when the right time has come, one is able to take appropriate action. I am sure that Mrs. Mackenzie and her friends will agree if now other conference members who have come from different countries, and who may also have ideas upon this subject, will come forward and voice their suggestions. Mrs. K. Hogg. Today we have heard a great deal about England. We are pleased about this, and have found it useful. But there are various other matters which we, who have come from our little Holland, have on our heart. Actually, we have come with a very guilty conscience, because the idea of a world school movement was discussed for the first time in Holland. Somehow, we did not do what we might have done about it, partly because of misunderstandings and partly because of lack of strength. But we have not been quite as inactive as people might think, and I can assure you that we are more than ready to make good our failure as far as this is possible. Despite our shortcoming, I should like to ask Dr. Steiner to tell us whether the plan he outlined for England could also be implemented in Holland. And since Dr. Steiner has promised to visit us in April, I should like to ask him whether he might be willing to discuss this matter with a larger circle of persons who have a particular interest in education. Rudolf Steiner. There already exists a plan for Holland, which, as far as I know, is being worked out. From the 5th to the 12th of April of this year, an academic course is to be held there, which, similar to other such courses given elsewhere, has the task, first and foremost, of introducing anthroposophy at depth. It has been a somewhat depressing experience to witness how, after the need to work for anthroposophy in Holland had been pointed out again and again, and after February and the beginning of March of last year, lectures and performances had been given, there was a notable falling off, not with regard to the understanding of anthroposophy, but definitely as far as the inner life of the Anthroposophical Society in Holland was concerned. It therefore seems to me very necessary that, especially in Holland, the anthroposophical movement should make a new and vigorous start. From which angle this should be done will depend on prevailing circumstances, but the educational movement could well be the prime mover. Another question has been handed to me, which has a direct bearing on this point. X. According to Dutch law, it is possible to found a free school if the government is satisfied of the serious and genuine intentions behind such an impulse. If we in Holland were unable to raise the necessary capital for founding a Waldorf school, would it be right for us to accept state subsidies, as long as we were allowed to arrange our curriculum and our lessons according to Waldorf principles? Rudolf Steiner. There is one part of the question I do not understand, and another which fills me with doubts. What I cannot understand is that in Holland it should not be possible to get enough money together for a really free school. Forgive me if I am naive, but I do not understand it. For I believe that if there is enough enthusiasm, it should at least be possible to start such a school. After all, not so very much money is needed to start a school. The other point which seems dubious to me is that it should be possible to run a school with the aid of state subsidies, for I very much doubt whether the government, if it pays out money for such a school, would not insist on the right to inspect it. Therefore, I cannot believe that a free school could be founded with state subsidies, which in themselves imply supervision by inspectors of the education authorities. It was yet another stroke of good luck for the Waldorf School in Stuttgart that it was founded just before the new Republican National Assembly had passed a law forbidding the opening of independent schools. For is it not true to say that with an increasing liberalization we are actually losing our liberty more and more? So that now, when in Germany we are living in a time of progress, most likely it would no longer be possible to found a Waldorf school in Stuttgart. But it was founded just in time. Now the eyes of the world are on the Waldorf school. It will be allowed to exist until those circles which have been instrumental in instituting the so-called elementary schools will become so powerful that out of mistaken fanaticism they will do away with the first four classes of the Waldorf school. I hope that this can be prevented, but also in this respect we are facing menacing times. This is the reason why I keep on emphasizing the importance of putting into deeds as soon as possible what needs to be done. For a wave is spreading all over the world, which is fast moving toward state dictatorship. It is a fact that Western civilization is exposing itself to the dangers of one day becoming flooded over by a culture of some kind of Asiatic character, which will have a spirituality of its own. People are closing their eyes to it, but nevertheless it will happen. To return to our point, I think that more or less it amounts to a delaying of the issue if one believes that one should first claim state help before starting a school. Somehow this does not look promising to me at all, but perhaps other people have different views upon the subject. I ask everyone present to voice their opinion freely. X. He states that at the present time it is not possible to found a school in Holland without interference by the state, which would demand, for instance, that a certain set curriculum would be achieved, and so on. Rudolf Steiner. If these things were not as they are, I should never have decided at that time, to form a world school movement, for as an idea it borders on the theoretical. But since the situation is as you described it, I thought that such a movement would have its practical uses. The matter is like this. Let us take as an example the little school which we used to have here in Dornach. For the reason already mentioned several times, we only managed to have a very small school because of our everlasting, quote, superabundance of lack of funds, close quote. Children aged below and above 10 came together in this school. Now, in the local state of Solothurn in Switzerland, such a state is called a canton, there exists a very strict law in education, which in actual fact is not so much different from similar laws all over Switzerland. This law is so fixed that when the local education authorities found out that we were actually teaching children under the age of 14, they declared such a school to be totally unacceptable. Such a thing was simply unheard of. Whatever we would have done to come to some agreement, we should never have been given permission to apply Waldorf methods in teaching children under 14. Hindrances of this kind will, of course, be placed in our way all over the continent. How this would work in England, I dare not say at the moment. However, if it should be possible to found a totally free school there, it would really mean a stupendous step forward. But because one meets resistance practically everywhere, whenever one tries to put Waldorf education into practice, I thought that a worldwide movement for the renewal of education might possibly be of some practical value. I hope that it might make an impact on people interested in education, thus creating possibilities for founding new Waldorf schools. For I consider it of utmost importance to bring about a counter-movement against present-day currents which have reached their culmination in Bolshevism in Russia. These currents find their fulfillment in absolute state dictatorship in education. One can see it looming everywhere, but people don't realize that Lunacharsky is only the ultimate consequence of what lies thus latent all over Europe. As long as it does not interfere with people's private lives, the existence of such currents of thought is conveniently ignored. Well, in my opinion, one should react by generating a counter-movement against, working against Lunacharsky's principle. Quote, the state is to be made into a giant machine, and each citizen is to be a cog within this machine. Close quote. The counter-movement should have as its aim to educate each person. It is this which is so necessary. In this respect, one can make most painful experiences, even in the anthroposophical movement. Today it would be possible to call into life, from out of the grounds of the anthroposophical movement, also a real medical movement. All the antecedents are there. But what would be needed is a movement capable of putting this impulse before the eyes of the world. Yet everywhere one finds a tendency of calling those who are able to represent a truly human medicine quacks, thus putting them outside the law. As an example, which is entirely unconnected with the anthroposophical medical movement, I should like to tell you of what happened in the case of a minister in the German government who rigorously upheld a strict law against the freedom of the healing profession, a law which is still operative today. However, when members of his own family fell ill, he surreptitiously called for help on unqualified healers, thus showing that where his own family was concerned, he did not believe in the official medical science, but only in what the law condemned as quackery. This is symptomatic of the root causes of sectarianism. A movement can free itself from them if it will stand up to the world, fully within the laws of the land, so that there can be no confusion with regard to the legal aspects. And this is what I had in mind with regard to the World School movement. I wished to create the right mood for the introduction of laws which would grant freedom to found schools entirely out of the needs for educational renewal. Schools can never be rightly founded out of majority decisions. This is why they cannot be run by the state. So much about the planned World School movement, an idea which in itself does not at all appeal to me. I am not in sympathy with it, because it would have led to the founding of an international association, a world club, and to the creation of a platform for the purpose of making propaganda. My way is to work directly where the needs of the times present themselves. All propaganda making, all agitating, is alien to me. I abhor these things. But if one's hands are tied, and if there is no possibility to found free schools, one first has to create the right climate for ideas, which may eventually lead to freedom in education. Compromises may well be justified in various instances, but we are living in times in which each compromise is likely to pull us still further into difficulties. Question. How can we best work in political life? Rudolf Steiner. I believe that if we were to look at the deep and significant questions which we are to discuss here, from a political angle, we should digress too much from our main theme. Unless present-day politics undergo a regeneration, at least in the various countries known to me on the physical plane, they hold but little promise for me. I am of the opinion that just in this area such definite symptoms of decadence are clearly noticeable, that one would expect society to realize the need for renewal, for example, the threefold social order. Such a movement would then be running side by side with the anthroposophical movement. Where has the old social order landed us? I will indicate this only very briefly, thereby possibly causing misunderstandings. Where has the old social order, which did not recognize its own threefold nature, landed us? Where has it landed us? It has led to a situation in which the destinies of whole populations were determined by political parties whose ideological backgrounds consisted of nothing but phrases. None can maintain that the phrases used nowadays by the various political parties contain anything of real substance. A few days ago I drew attention to Bismarck, who in his later life became a rigid monarchist, although in his younger years he had been something of a bashful and masked republican. This is how he spoke of himself. This same Bismarck made certain utterances which expressed the same opinions as those made by Robespierre. Anyone can make all kinds of statements. What matters in the end is what comes to light when the real ideology of a party reveals itself. For some years I was a worker at the Berlin Center for the Education of the Working Classes, which was a purely social democratic institution, footnote, from 1899 to 1904, end of footnote. I always availed myself of any opportunity to spread the truth wherever people were willing to listen, no matter what the political color or program was of the organizers of such institutions. And so among people who, by their political outlook, were rigid Marxists, I taught a purely anthroposophical approach to life, both in courses on natural science and on history. Even when giving speech exercises to the workers, I was able to express my deepest inner convictions. The numbers of my students grew larger and larger, and lo and behold, the Social Democratic Party leaders soon began to take notice. It came to a decisive meeting, attended not only by party leaders, but also by all my adult students, who were unanimous in their wish to continue with their courses. But 3 to 4 party leaders stolidly declared that this kind of teaching had no place in their establishment, because it was undermining the character of the Social Democratic Party. In my reply, I declared that surely the Social Democratic Party wanted to build for the future, and that since mankind inevitably was moving toward greater freedom, a future school or educational institution would have to respect man's freedom. Then a typical party member rose and said, "Freedom in education we do not know. What we know is a reasonable form of compulsion." This was the decisive turning point, which finally led to the closing down of my courses. Although it may appear rather silly and big-headed for me to say so, I feel convinced that had the fast-growing movement among the students of the courses I gave there at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century been allowed to live and expand unchecked, conditions in Middle Europe would have been different during the 1920s. And so you can see that I do not have much trust in working with political parties, especially with socialist parties, especially with socialist parties you will least succeed in bringing freedom into education. They, above all, will strive in most incredible ways for the abolition of freedom in education. As for the Christian parties, they are bound to clamor for independent schools, simply because of the constitution of the present German government. But if they were placed at the helm, they would immediately claim this freedom in education only to suit themselves. It is a simple fact that we shall not be able to make progress in public life unless we first create the necessary foundations for a threefold social order in which the democratic element prevails exclusively in the middle sphere, namely in the sphere of rights. This in itself would safeguard the possibility of freedom in education. We shall never achieve it through electioneering. Z. If children of the present generation were educated according to the principles of anthroposophical knowledge, would this in itself be sufficient to stem the tide of decadence and decay? Or would it not be necessary for them to be sent out into the world with the declared intent to change present society in order to bring about a new social organism? Rudolf Steiner. The ideas which I tried to express in my book titled Toward Social Renewal, 1919, are hardly understood completely. The reasons which led me to write this book are decades old. Mankind has reached a stage when someone who might turn up with the best and most promising ideas about improving social life and people's social attitudes would not be able to bring them to fruition simply because of the lack of practical possibilities available for such purposes. The first step would be to create the right conditions for people to be able to implement their opinions and their insights into social life. I, therefore, do not believe it helpful to ask whether, if a generation were to be educated in the way we have been describing, then the desired social conditions would automatically follow, or whether a change of the social order in one or another direction would still be necessary. I should like to say, we must be clear that the best we could achieve in practical life would be for us to help as many members of one generation as possible to make progress through an education based on knowledge of man. This in itself would obviate the second question, for the thoughts and ideas needed to change society would be the very ones such a generation would develop. Since their human conditions would be different from those of the general public today, they would have quite different possibilities for implementing their aims. The point is that if we wish to be practical, we have to think in practical and not in theoretical terms. And to think practically means to do what lies in the realm of possibilities and not to attempt to realize an ideal. Our most promising aim would be to give to as many members of one generation as possible an education which springs from knowledge of man, and then to trust that these former pupils in their adult lives would also be able to bring about a desirable social order. The second question can be answered only through the deeds of those who, through their education, have been prepared for the task which you outlined. It cannot be answered theoretically. Question. How can one make use of what we have heard in this course of lectures for the education of seriously mentally retarded children? Rudolf Steiner. In answer to this question, I should like to give you an actual and practical example. When I was 23 or 24, I was called to work as a tutor in a family of four boys. Three of the boys presented no educational problems, but one of them, who at that time was 11 years old, had the following prehistory. At the age of 7, a private tutor had tried in vain to teach him according to the accepted methods of an elementary school. You must remember that this happened in Austria, where it was possible for anyone to teach children quite freely, because the only thing that mattered was that they should pass an examination at the end of each year. Pupils were allowed to sit for these exams at any of the state schools. No one bothered about whether they had been taught by angels or by devils, as long as they passed their exam, which was looked upon as proof of their proper education. Well, among those four boys, there was one who had some 4 to nearly 5 years of such private coaching behind him. His latest drawing book was presented to me. He was then 11 years old, which he had brought home from his last annual exam. In all other subjects, he had either remained completely silent or talked sheer nonsense, but he had not put anything down on paper. His drawing book was the only document he had handed in during his exam, and all it could boast of was a big hole in the paper of the first page. For all he had done was to scribble something down, only to rub it out immediately afterward, until only one big hole was left as evidence of his efforts. It was the only tangible result of his exam. In other respects, it proved to be impossible, sometimes for several weeks on end, to get him to talk, or even to say one single word to anyone. For a time he also refused to eat at table. Instead he went into the kitchen, where he ate out of the garbage can. He ate refuse, but not proper food. I am describing these symptoms in fair detail, so that you can see that here one had to deal with a child who certainly belonged to the category of the, quote, seriously mentally handicapped, close quote. And now, I was told, with that child nothing much can be done, for everything has been tried already. Even the family doctor, who, by the way, was one of the leading medical practitioners of Vienna and a greatly respected authority, had given up the boy, and the entire family was very unhappy. One just did not know what to do with that boy. I requested that the education of this child, as also that of the other three brothers, was to be left entirely in my hands, and that I should be given complete freedom in how to deal with the boy. All members of the family refused to grant me this freedom, all except the boy's mother. Out of certain unconscious depths, mothers sometimes do have the right feelings for such things. The boy was given unto my care. When preparing my lessons, above all else I followed the principle of approaching such a child, who would be commonly called feeble-minded, entirely from the point of view of his physical development. This meant that everything that was to be done had to be based on the same principles which I have already elaborated to you for the healthy child. What matters in such a case is that one gains the possibility of looking into the inner being of such a child. He was a marked hydrocephalus. This meant that it was very difficult to treat this boy. And so my first principle had to be, here, education meant healing. It had to be placed upon a medical basis. After 2.5 years, the boy had made enough progress to be able to work at the curriculum of a grammar school, for I had succeeded in teaching him with the strictest economy. At times I limited his academic work to only a quarter, or at most to 30 minutes per day. In order to be able to concentrate the right content into such a short time, I sometimes needed some 4 hours' preparation for a lesson lasting about 30 minutes. To me, the most important thing was that he should not be under any strain whatsoever. I did exactly as I thought fit, for I had reserved the right to do so. Much time was spent on music lessons, for these seemed to help the boy. From week to week, this musical activity was increased, and I could observe how gradually his physical condition was changing. Admittedly, I did not allow any interference from anybody. The rest of the family, with the exception of the boy's mother, registered their objections when they noticed that time and again the boy looked pale. I insisted on my rights, and told them that now it was up to me whether I made him look pale or very pale. I told them that he would look ruddy again when the right time came. My guiding line was to base the entire education of this child upon insight into his physical condition, and to arrange all soul and spiritual measures accordingly. I believe that the details will always vary in each individual case. One has to know the human being thoroughly and intimately, and therefore I must point out, time and again, that everything depends on a real knowledge of man. When I asked myself the question, quote, "What is the boy's actual age, and how do I have to treat him?" close quote, I realized that he had remained a young child of 2.25 years, and that I should have to treat him as such, despite the fact that according to his birth certificate he had completed his 11th year. I had to teach him according to his actual mental age. Always keeping my eyes on the boy's condition of health and applying strictest soul economy, at first I based my teaching entirely on the principle of imitation, which meant that everything had to be systematically built upon his powers of imitation. I then went on to what today I called, quote, further structuring, close quote, of lessons. Within 2.5 years, the boy had made sufficient progress for him to be able to study the curriculum of a grammar school. I continued helping him, also during the time when he was a pupil at the grammar school. He was finally weaned of any extra help. In fact, he was able to go through the last two classes of his school entirely independently. Afterward, he became a medical doctor who held his practice for many years, to die approximately at the age of 40 from an infection which he had contracted in Poland during the World War I. This is just one example. I could quote many another one, to show that especially in the case of feeble-minded children, one needs to apply the same principles which I have elaborated here for healthy children. In the Waldorf School there are quite a number of slightly and also seriously mentally retarded children, to quote the phraseology of the question. Naturally, the more serious cases would disturb their classmates, and therefore we have opened a special remedial class for feeble-minded children of mixed ages, whose members are drawn from all our present classes. This group is under the guidance of Dr. Schubert. But whenever one has to decide whether to send a child into this remedial class, I have the joy, if I may express it so, of having to fight with the class teacher concerned. None of our class teachers want to let a member of his class go. Every one of them will put up a fight to keep such a child, doing his or her utmost to carry it within the class, often successfully. Although our classes are by no means small, by giving individual attention, it is possible to keep such children in their classes. The more serious cases, however, have to be put into our remedial group, where it is absolutely essential to give them individual treatment. Dr. Schubert, who is freed from having to follow any set curriculum, lets himself be guided entirely by the individual needs of each child. Consequently, he may be doing things with his children which are completely different from what is usually done in a classroom. The main thing is to find the specific treatment from which each child will benefit. For instance, there may be some very dull-witted children in such a group, and once one has developed the necessary sense for these things, one may realize that their faculty of making mental pictures is so slow that they lose the images during the process of making them. They lose mental images. They never achieve making them. This is only one type of retardation. One can help such children if instead of giving them the ordinary kind of schoolwork, one calls out unexpected commands, if they are capable of grasping their meaning. We have also children who are unable to follow such instructions, and then one has to think of something different. For instance, one may suddenly call out to them, quote, "Quickly, hold your left earlobe between your right thumb and second finger. Quickly, grip your right arm with your left hand." Close quote. If in this way one lets them orient themselves first by their own body geography, and then by objects belonging to the world outside, one may be able to make real headway with such children. Another way would be to try to get them to recognize quickly what one has drawn on the blackboard. Here Rudolf Steiner drew an ear on the board. It is not at all so easy to get such a child to respond by saying ear, but it is this flash of recognition which matters. One has to think up the most varied things in order to wake up such children. It is this awakening, this becoming active, which can lead to progress, though naturally not in the case of children who fly into uncontrollable tempers. They have to be dealt with differently, but these examples may at least indicate the direction in which one has to move. What matters is the individual treatment, and this must spring from a real knowledge of the human being. From the discussion of 5th January 1922, held in the evening, Rudolf Steiner. Several questions have been handed in, and I will try to answer them as far as this is possible within the short time available. Regarding the first question, the answer to the question about the relationship between sensory and motor nerves is, to begin with, a matter of interpretation. As long as one considers it from a physical point of view alone, one can hardly reach a conclusion which differs from the customary one. According to the usual interpretation, one is dealing with the central organ. Let me take a simple case of nerve conduction. In this case, the sensation would be transmitted from the periphery to the central organ, from which the motor impulse would be passed on to the appropriate organ. Now, as long as one considers the physical aspect only, as I have already said, it is perfectly possible to be satisfied with this explanation. Neither do I believe that any other interpretation would be acceptable, unless one is willing to consider facts which result from supersensible observations, that is, from fully comprehensive and real observations. As already said, when I was dealing with this question during the last few days, from an anatomical and physiological point of view, the difference between the sensory and motor nerves is not a very significant one. I did not say that there was no difference, but I did say that the difference was not very marked. The actual anatomical difference does not contradict the interpretation given by me. Let me repeat it. We are dealing here with only one type of nerves. The so-called sensory and motor nerves are of one and the same kind, and therefore it does not really matter whether one chooses the term sensory or motor nerve. Such a distinction is irrelevant, because the soul experiences, of which these nerves are the physical tools, if one wishes to use such a metaphor, are not strictly differentiated from each other. For in every thought process, there also lives a will process, and vice versa. In every predominant will process, there is also an element of thought, or a residue of sense perception, even though these processes remain mainly in the unconscious. And now, every will impulse, be it a direct one or the result of a thought, always has its beginning within the upper reaches of man's members, namely in the mutual working together of the ego and the astral body. If we now follow through a will impulse, with all its accompanying processes, we are not led to the nerves at all, for every will impulse directly intervenes in the human metabolism. The difference between the interpretation which must be given on the basis of anthroposophical research and that given by ordinary science consists in the latter's claim that a will impulse is first transmitted to the nerves before the relevant organs are induced to perform the various movements. In reality, this is not so, because a soul impulse directly initiates metabolic processes in the organism. Let us take as example a sensation, that is something revealed by a physical sense, say in the human eye, EYE. In this case, the whole process would have to be drawn in greater detail. First, a process would be going on in the eye, to be subsequently transmitted to the optic nerve, which, according to ordinary science, is classed as a sensory nerve. This optic nerve is the physical mediator of seeing. If we really want to get at the truth of the matter, I have to make a correction regarding what I said just now. I spoke a little hesitantly about the nerves being the physical tools or instruments of human soul experiences, because such a comparison does not really convey the correct meaning of physical organs and organic systems in the human being. One has to think of it in the following way. Let us assume that here there is soft ground on a pathway, Rudolf Steiner began to draw, and that a cart was being driven over this soft ground. It would leave tracks behind from which I could tell exactly where the wheels had been. Now imagine that someone would come along to explain the existence of these tracks by saying, quote, here in these places the earth must have developed various kinds of forces which have pressed in the soft ground. Close quote. Such an interpretation would be completely illusionary, for it was not at all the earth which had been active. On the contrary, something was done to the earth. The cart wheels had gone over it, and the cause of the tracks had nothing to do whatever with an activity of the earth. Something similar is happening in the nervous system of our brain. What is active there are soul and spiritual processes. With other words, the cart. What is left behind are the tracks, the imprints. These can be found. But whatever is perceived in the brain, whatever is retained anatomically and physiologically, has nothing to do with the brain as such, for it has been pressed in or molded, sculpted, by the activities of soul and spirit. It is therefore not surprising that one finds in the brain everything that corresponds to the happenings within the soul and spiritual sphere. But in reality, this has nothing to do with the brain itself. The metaphor of physical tools or instruments is therefore not a correct one. Rather, should one look upon the whole process in a similar way in which I can look upon my walking. My walking is in no way initiated by the ground on which I walk. The earth is not my tool. But if it were not there, I could not walk. That's how it is. My thinking as such, that is, the content of my soul and spiritual life, in itself, has nothing to do with my brain. But the brain is the ground by means of which this soul content is retained. It is through this process of retention that man becomes conscious of his soul content. So you see that the real situation is quite different from what one usually imagines. There has to be such a resistance wherever there is a sensation, whenever a sense perception takes place. Just in the same way in which a process is going on, say in the eye, which can be perceived with the help of the so-called sensory nerve, so in the will impulses taking place, for example, in the leg, a process is going on, and it is this process which is being perceived with the help of the nerve. The so-called sensory nerves are organs of perception, which spread outwardly into the senses. The so-called motor nerves are nerves which spread inward in order to convey the perceptions of what the will forces are doing, thus making us aware of what the will is doing while it is working directly through the metabolism. Both sensory and motor nerves transmit sensations, the former ones spreading in an outward direction, while the latter ones are working inward. There is no significant difference between the two kinds of nerves. The function of the first kind is to communicate an awareness of processes going on in the sense organs in form of thought processes, while the other, the, in quotes, motor nerve, communicates processes taking place in the interior physical body, also in form of thought processes. If one makes the well-known and usual experiments of cutting the spinal marrow in a tabes dorsalis case, or if one interprets this disorder realistically and without the usual prejudice of materialistic physiology, this illness can be explained particularly clearly. For in the case of tabes dorsalis, the appropriate nerve, I now will call it a sensory nerve, which under normal circumstances could make a movement sense perceptible, is defunct, and consequently the actual movement cannot be made. For only when such a process is consciously perceived can movement take place. It is like this. Imagine a piece of chalk with which I want to do something, but unless I can perceive it with my senses, I cannot carry out my intention. In a similar way, in the case of tabes dorsalis, the mediating nerve cannot function because it is injured, and consequently there is no transmission of sensation. The patient loses the possibility of using it. In the same way, I would be unable to use a piece of chalk if it were lying somewhere in a dark room where I cannot find it. Tabes dorsalis is due to the patient's inability to find the appropriate organs with the help of the sensory nerves which enter the spinal marrow. This is rather a rough and ready explanation, but it certainly would be possible to explain it also in greater detail. In each single case, the cutting of the nerves is an absolute proof for this interpretation, if one looks upon them in the right way. This particular interpretation is the outcome of anthroposophical research. By this I mean that it rests on direct observation. What matters is that one is able to use outer phenomena to substantiate one's interpretation. To give another example, a so-called motor nerve can be cut or damaged. If one joins it to a sensory nerve and allows it to heal, it will function again. With other words, it is possible to join together the appropriate ends of a so-called sensory nerve with a so-called motor nerve, and after healing, the result will be a uniform functioning. If the two kinds of nerves were radically different from each other, such a process would be impossible. There is yet another possibility. Let us take it in its simplest form. Here Rudolf Steiner made a drawing. We here have a so-called sensory nerve, which goes to the spinal cord, and a so-called motor nerve, which leaves the spinal cord, in fact also a sensory nerve. This would be a case of uniform conduction. In actual fact, all this represents a uniform conduction. And if we take, for example, a simple reflex movement, a uniform process is taking place. Imagine a simple reflex motion. A fly settles on my eyelid. I chase it away through a reflex motion. The whole process is a uniform one. What is happening is merely an interpretation here. One could compare it with an electric switch, with a lead toward it and one lead away from it. The process is really a uniform one, only it is interpreted here, drawing, just as if I had an electric current where, when I interrupt the current, an electric spark flashes across. When the switch is closed, there is no spark. When it is open, there is a spark as a sign of a break in the circuit. Such uniform conductions are also present in the brain. They act as links in a similar way, in which if I interrupt an electric current passing through a wire, there will be an electric spark. If I see a spark, I have a break in the nerve current, drawing. It is as if the nerve fluid were jumping across like an electric spark, if I may use such a coarse expression. It is this which gives the soul the possibility of experiencing this process consciously. If it were a case of a uniform nerve current passing through without a break in the circuit, it would simply pass through the body without the soul being able to experience anything. This is what I can say about it for the moment. These theories are generally accepted in all countries of the world, and if I am asked where one can find more detailed knowledge, I even quote Huxley's book on physiology as a basic standard work upon the subject. Footnote: Thomas H. Huxley, titled Fundamentals of Physiology, end of footnote. There is one more point I wish to make. This whole question is really a subtle one, and the usual interpretations certainly appear convincing. To prove their correctness, the so-called sensory parts of a nerve are cut, and then the motor parts of a nerve are cut, with the aim of showing that what is interpreted as sensation or as movement no longer can take place. But if you take what I have said in its entirety, especially with regard to the interrupter switch, you will be able to understand all the various experiments made with cutting nerves. Question: how can the educator best meet requests for various activities coming from children aged between 5.5 and 7? Rudolf Steiner. At this age, a feeling for authority already begins to make itself felt, as I tried to indicate in the lectures here. Yet chiefly predominant is a longing for imitation, and this gives us a clue for what to do with such children. The movable picture books which I have mentioned are particularly suitable for them, for they stimulate the children's awakening powers of fantasy. If they ask to do something, and as soon as we have the opportunity of opening a kindergarten in Stuttgart, we shall try to put this into practice. If the children want to be engaged in some activity, we shall paint or model with them in the simplest way, first by doing it in front of them while they are watching. If children have already shed their teeth, one does not paint for them first, but encourages them to paint their own pictures. Only when the teacher wants to lead over to writing via drawing or painting, will he or she again appeal to the children's powers of imitation. But generally speaking, in a kindergarten for children aged between 5.5 and 7, one would first do the various activities in front of them, and then let the children repeat them in their own way, thus gradually leading over from the principle of imitation to that of authority. Naturally, this can be done in different ways. It is quite possible to get children to work on their own. For instance, one could first do something with them, such as modeling or drawing, which then they are asked to repeat on their own. One has to invent various possibilities of letting them supplement and complete what the teacher has already started. One can show them that such a piece of work is complete only when the child has made 5 or 10 more such parts, which together must form an entity. In this way, one can combine the principle of imitation with that of authority. It will become a really stimulating task for us to develop such ideas in practice when we have a kindergarten in the Waldorf school. Of course, it would be perfectly right for you to develop these ideas yourself. It would take up too much of our time if I were to go into greater details now. Question: will it be possible to have this course of lectures published in English? Rudolf Steiner. Such things are always a question of time. But I myself would like to have the shorthand version of this course written out in full as soon as possible. And when this is done, one can take the necessary steps to have it published also in English. Question. Should children be taught to play musical instruments? And if so, which ones? Rudolf Steiner. In the Waldorf School, I have definitely advocated the principle that apart from introducing children to music in a more general way, at least those children who show some special gifts should also learn to play a musical instrument according to technical possibilities. The choice of the instrument should not be made beforehand, but only in consultation with the music teacher. A really good music teacher will soon find out whether a child, on entering school, shows any specific gifts, which in themselves may indicate a leaning toward one or another instrument. This is a case where one should definitely try to treat each child individually. Naturally, in the Waldorf School, all these things are still in the beginning stage. But in spite of this, we have managed to get together quite acceptable small orchestras and quartets. Question. Do you think that composing in the Greek modes, which were discovered by Miss Schlesinger, would mean a real step forward with regard to the future of music? Footnote. See Kathleen Schlesinger's title, The Greek Aulos, A-U-L-O-S, 1939, end of footnote. Would it be advisable to have instruments such as the piano tuned in such modes? Would it be a good thing for us to get accustomed to these modes? Rudolf Steiner. For several reasons, I am of the opinion that music will make progress in its development if what I should like to call the intensive melody will gradually play a more and more important role. Footnote. See answers to questions given on 29th of September 1920 entitled The Nature of Music and Man's Experience of Tone, GA 283, also titled Eurythmia's Visible Song, GA 278, the lecture given on 21st of February 1924. End of footnote. This intensive melody would consist in one's becoming used to experiencing the sound of one single note already as a kind of melody. One will become accustomed to a greater complexity of the tones of each single sound. This will eventually happen. When this stage is reached, it also will lead to a certain modification of our scales, simply because the intervals will be, in quotes, filled out in a different way from what one is used to. They will be filled out more concretely, and this in itself will lead to a greater appreciation of certain elements found in what I should like to call archetypal music, Urmusik, elements inherent also in Miss Schlesinger's discoveries, in which significant and important features can be recognized. I do believe that these will open a way toward enriching the experience of music and toward overcoming certain limitations imposed by our more or less fortuitous scales with all they have brought with them. So I agree that a fostering of this particular discovery does offer prospects for progress in musical development. Question. Will it also be possible to give eurythmy to physically handicapped children, or possibly curative eurythmy to fit each individual case, each individual child? Rudolf Steiner. Yes, certainly. One only has to find the way to use eurythmy in such different situations. First, one has to look at the already existing general forms of eurythmy, and then one must consider whether a deformed child would be able to make the movements involved, or whether one may have to modify them. This can be done in any case. The way forward would be to use the existing artistic eurythmy for such children, and this will be of special benefit for the very young, and also for young children. Quite surprising progress in the healing processes of such children may result from working with ordinary eurythmy. Curative eurythmy was systematically worked out, first by myself during a supplementary course given here in Dornach in 1921, immediately after the last course given to medical doctors. Footnote. During the second course given to doctors and medical students from 11th to 18th April 1921, Dr. Steiner developed a therapeutic eurythmy, now practiced by specially trained curative eurythmists in cooperation with qualified doctors. See titled Curative Eurythmy, a course of 8 lectures given in Dornach from the 12th to the 18th of April, 1921, and also in Stuttgart on 28th of October, 1922, GA 315. End of footnote. Its immediate task is to serve the various healing processes. This curative eurythmy is definitely suitable also for children suffering from malformations. For lighter cases, the already existing forms of curative eurythmy will suffice. In more severe cases, these forms may have to be intensified or modified. However, any such modifications will have to be made with great caution. Artistic eurythmy will not harm anybody. It can be only beneficial. Harmful consequences will accrue only through excessive or exaggerated eurythmy practice, as would happen in any other field of movement. Naturally, just as one can make oneself ill by excessive efforts in mountaineering, or if, for example, one uses one's arms too much, so can an excessive eurythmy practice lead to all kinds of exhaustion, to general asthenia. However, here the cause does not lie in eurythmy, but in its wrong application. Any wholesome activities can lead to illnesses if they are grossly exaggerated. In the case of ordinary eurythmy, it is unthinkable that it could have a harmful effect upon anyone. However, when one is dealing with curative eurythmy, one must be heedful of the general rule I gave during the curative eurythmy course. It is that curative eurythmy exercises should be planned only under the guidance and supervision of a doctor and jointly by the doctor and curative eurythmist, and this only after a proper medical diagnosis has been made. If curative exercises have to be intensified, it is absolutely essential that one proceeds in a strictly medical and surgical basis, and that only a specialist of pathological conditions, of pathological peculiarities, is capable of deciding what measures need to be taken. Just as it would be irresponsible to allow unqualified persons to deal with the dispensing of dangerous drugs and poisons, so it would be equally irresponsible to allow just anyone to meddle with curative eurythmy. If injury does result from such bungling, one really cannot lay the blame upon curative eurythmy. Question. In yesterday's lecture, we heard about abnormal consequences resulting from a shift of what was right for one period of life into later periods, and of the subsequent emergence of a superphlegmatic and a supersanguine temperament. The first question is, how does a pronouncedly choleric temperament come into existence? And secondly, how can one perceive whether a young child has an inclination toward an unbalanced melancholic or any one of the other three temperaments? Thirdly, is it possible to counteract such imbalances already before the change of teeth? Rudolf Steiner. The choleric temperament comes into being mainly through a person's ego working particularly strongly during one of the nodal points of life, which occur around the second year and again during the ninth and seventh and tenth year. There are also other nodal points later in life, but the first two are of main interest to us here. It is not the case that the ego begins to exist only in the 21st year, but that it becomes free at a certain age. It is always there in every human being, from the moment of birth, or rather from the third week after conception. This ego can reach too great an intensity, and then it works particularly strongly during these special times. What is the meaning and the nature of such a nodal point? Between the ninth and tenth year, the ego works with great intensity, manifesting itself in that the child learns to differentiate him or herself from the surroundings. In order to retain normal conditions, a stability of equilibrium is needed, especially at this stage. For it can happen that this state of equilibrium undergoes a shift in an outward direction, and this can become one of the many causes of the sanguine temperament. When I spoke about the temperaments yesterday, I made a special point in saying that different contributory factors were working together, and that I was going to single out those which were of importance from a certain point of view. Now, it is also possible that the center of gravity shifts inward. This can happen already when the child is learning to speak, or even when it learns to hold itself in an upright position, when it begins to pull itself up. At such moments, there is always an opportunity for the ego to work too strongly. One has to pay attention to this and must try not to do anything wrong at this point of life. This one would do if, for example, one forced a child to stand upright, unsupported too early. It should do so only when it has developed the necessary faculty to imitate the vertical position of the adult. One can appreciate the importance of this if one pays heed to what man's upright position really means. In general, the animal is constituted in such a way that its spinal column is more or less parallel to the surface of the earth. There are, of course, exceptions, but these can also be explained just on the basis of their difference. Man, on the other hand, is constituted in such a way that in his normal position his spine extends in the same direction as the earth's radius. This is the radical difference between man and animal. And in this radical difference there lies one's reply to purely Darwinistic materialists. I am not saying Darwinians, but to Darwinistic materialists. When they deny that there exists a characteristic difference between a human skeleton and that of a higher animal, because both have the same number of bones, and so on. Admittedly, this is correct. But the animal's skeleton has a horizontal spine, and man's spine is vertical. In this vertical position of the human spine is manifested a relationship to the entire cosmos, and the meaning of this relationship is that man becomes the bearer of an ego. When we talk about the animal, we only speak of three members, namely of the physical body, of the ether body or body of formative forces, and the astral body. An ego can incarnate only if a being is organized in line with the vertical. I once spoke about this during one of my lectures, and afterwards someone came to me and said, quote, "But what about the human being when he sleeps? Surely then his spine lies horizontally," close quote. So often people fail to grasp the point of what I say. Here the point is not merely that the human spine is constituted for the vertical position only when a person is standing, but that one has to look at the entire build of man, at the mutual relationships and positions of the bones, which result in his walking with a vertical spinal column, whereas in the case of the animal, the spine remains in the horizontal. The point is that the vertical position of the human spine is the characteristic distinguishing mark for the fact that man is the bearer of an ego. And now observe how the physiognomical character of a person is expressed particularly strongly through the vertical. You may have noticed, if only the appropriate means of observation were used, that there are people who show certain anomalies in their physical growth, that, for instance, according to their organic nature, they were meant to reach a certain height, but that through the agency of another organic system, working in the opposite direction, the human form became compressed. It is absolutely possible that, because of certain antecedents, the physical structure of a person, which was meant to be larger, was pressed together by an organic system working in the opposite direction. This was the case with Fichte, for example. I could quote many others, such as Napoleon, to mention only one of them. In accordance with certain parts of his organic systems, Fichte's stature could have been taller than it actually was, yet he remained stunted in his physical growth. This meant that his ego had to put up with having to exist in such a compressed body, and the choleric temperament is a direct expression of the ego. The choleric temperament can definitely be caused by such an abnormality of growth. Regarding the question, how can one perceive whether a young child has an inclination toward the melancholic or any of the other temperaments? Well, I believe that anyone who has frequently been in the company of children will hardly need special indications, for these symptoms almost force themselves upon one. Even with quite naive and untrained observation, one will be able to discriminate between a choleric and a melancholic child, just as one can clearly distinguish between a child who just sits, or another who appears morose and miserable, and again, between one who romps about wildly. In the classroom, it is very easy to spot a child who, after having paid momentary attention to what was on the blackboard, suddenly turns to his neighbor to find something of interest there, before looking out of the window again. This is what a sanguine is like. These are the things which can easily be observed on even quite a naive level. If next the question is asked whether one can work toward balancing these traits already before the change of teeth, the answer must be yes, and fundamentally so by the same methods to be applied at a later age, methods which have already been described. Only at such an early age these methods need to be couched in terms of imitation. Let us imagine a child who easily flies into tempers. If at the right age the adult stimulates similar tantrums, he may succeed in making such a child tired of its behavior. It is quite possible to achieve something that way. However, before the change of teeth, it is not at all necessary to try to counteract these temperamental inclinations, because in most cases it is good if these things are allowed to die a natural death. Of course, this can be rather uncomfortable for the grown-up. But here we have something about which one ought to think differently from the way this is usually done. I should like to clarify this point by a comparison. You probably know that there exists a type of lay healer who does not possess a thorough knowledge of the human organism, but who, nevertheless, is able to judge abnormalities, symptoms of illnesses, up to a certain degree. It may happen that such a healer recognizes an anomaly in the movements of his patient's heart. When asked what should be done about it, it really can happen that the answer is, leave the heart alone, for if one were to bring it back to its normal activity, the patient would not be able to stand it. This heart irregularity is just what he needs. In a similar way, it is often necessary to know how long a certain condition has to be left alone, and in the case of a choleric child, how much time it must be given to get over its tantrums simply by exhausting itself. This is what needs to be borne in mind. Question: how can a student of anthroposophy avoid losing the capacity to love and the faculty of remembering when crossing the boundary of sense-perceptible knowledge? Rudolf Steiner. This question appears to rest on the assumption that during the ordinary state of consciousness, love and the faculty of remembering are both necessary for life. In ordinary life, one could not exist without the faculty of remembering. Without this spring of memory leading each individual back to a certain point in early childhood, the continuity of the ego could not exist. Enough cases are known where this continuity has been destroyed, where definite gaps appear in the faculty of remembering. This is a pathological condition. In like manner, ordinary life cannot unfold without love. But now it needs to be said that when a state of higher consciousness is reached, this higher consciousness has a different content from that of the ordinary kind. The question seems to imply that because of crossing the limits of ordinary knowledge, there is no unfolding of love and memory beyond the boundaries of knowledge. This is quite correct. But at the same time, it has always been emphasized that the right kind of schooling consists in one's retaining qualities which one has developed for the ordinary consciousness, keeping them alive side by side with the newly won qualities. It is even requested, as you can find out in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, that these qualities, developed in ordinary life, should become enhanced and strengthened when one is entering a state of higher consciousness. This means that nothing is taken away as regards inner faculties developed during ordinary consciousness, and that what is required for higher consciousness is in addition to what was attained previously. To clarify this point, I should like to make use of a somewhat trivial comparison, even if it does not fully accord with the situation. As you know, if I wish to move myself by walking on the earth, I must not lose my sense of balance. Other things are needed as well in order to walk properly, that is, without swaying or falling. Well, if anyone learns to walk on a tightrope, he will lose nothing of the faculties which serve him in walking on the ordinary ground of the earth. If one learns how to walk on a tightrope, one meets completely different conditions. And yet a question such as, Can tightrope walking prevent one from being able to walk properly on an ordinary surface would be quite irrelevant. In a similar way, the attainment of a different consciousness will not prevent one from retaining the faculties belonging to ordinary consciousness, whereby I do not imply in any way that I wish to compare the attainment of higher consciousness with a kind of spiritual tightrope walking. Yet it is so that the faculties and qualities gained in the ordinary consciousness are to be fully preserved when one rises to a state of enhanced consciousness. And now, because of the lateness of the hour, I should like to settle the remaining questions as quickly as possible, in order to end our meeting by telling you a little story. Question. What should our attitude be toward the ever-increasing use of documentary films in schools, and how can we best explain to those defending their use that their harmful effects are not balanced by their potential educational value? Rudolf Steiner. I have tried to get behind the secrets of the film, and whether my findings will make people angry or not is not the point, for I am giving you the facts. I was forced to acknowledge that the film productions exert an extremely harmful effect upon what in my lectures here I have called the etheric or life body, and this especially with regard to the human sense organization. It is a fact that through watching film productions, the entire human soul spiritual constitution becomes mechanized. Films are outer means of turning people into materialists. I have tested these effects, especially during the war years, when film propaganda was made for all kinds of things. One could witness how the audiences avidly took in what was shown. I was not particularly interested in watching the films, but I did want to observe their effects on the audiences. And there one could see how the film is simply an intrinsic part of the plan for the materialization of mankind, already on account of its weaving materialism into the perceptual habits of those who are watching. Naturally, this could be taken very much further, but because of the lateness of the hour, there is only time for these brief indications. Question. How should one treat a child who, according to the parents, sang well in tune at the age of 3, and who now at the age of 7 sings badly out of tune? Rudolf Steiner. First, one would have to examine whether, through some occurrence or other, the musical ear of the child has not become masked for the time being. But if that child really sang well at the age of 3, if this is a correct statement, one should be able, with the appropriate pedagogical treatment, to help the child to sing in tune again. This could be done by studying the child's habits at the time when it had sung well. Find out how it occupied itself, what kinds of things it had done, and so on. Then, obviously, with the necessary modifications regarding age, place it again into the entire setting of those early years and approach the child with singing again. Try, quite methodically, to call forth again the entire situation of the child's early life. Possibly some other faculty may also have submerged, a faculty that might be recovered more easily. Question. What is anthroposophy's attitude towards the Montessori system of education, and what would the consequences of this system be? Rudolf Steiner. I am not really in sympathy with having to answer questions about contemporary methods, which generally are backed with a certain amount of fanaticism. Not that I dislike answering questions. But I have to admit that I do not like answering questions such as, what is anthroposophy's attitude toward this or that contemporary movement? There is no need for me to do so, for I consider it my task to represent before the world only what can be gained from anthroposophical research. I do not think that it is my task to throw light upon other matters from an anthroposophical point of view. Therefore, all I wish to say is that when aims and aspirations tend toward a certain artificiality, such as bringing to the very young child what does not form part of its natural surroundings, but what has been artificially invented and turned into a system, they cannot really be of benefit for the child's healthy development. A great number of new schools are being invented these days, but they all have in common that they do not rest upon a real and thorough knowledge of man. Of course, one can find a great deal of what is right in such a system, but in each instance it is necessary to reduce also the positive aspects to what accords with the real knowledge of man. And now, ladies and gentlemen, with regard to the time left over after the translation of this last part has been made, I should like to drop a hint. I do not wish to be so discourteous as to say in so many words that every hour has come to an end, but since I can see that many of our honored guests sitting here are feeling as I do, I wish to be polite enough to meet their wishes by telling a little story, a very short story. There once lived a Hungarian couple who always had guests in the evening. In Hungary, people were very hospitable before the times came when everything went topsy-turvy. And when the clock struck 10, the husband used to say to his wife, "Wife, we must be polite to our guests. We must retire now, because our guests surely will want to go home." Close quote. End of question and answers. There's a slight publisher's note that I'm going to add. Before the beginning of this conference, Rudolf Steiner addressed the participants who were gathered together in the White Hall of the First Gertianum with the following words. "Ladies and gentlemen, before beginning this lecture course, allow me to bring before you an administrative matter. Originally, this course was intended for an intimate circle only, but it has evoked such a response that it is obvious that we cannot share it in this tightly packed hall. It would be quite impossible. You would soon realize it if you would have to be present, not only during the lectures, but also during their translations. It is for this reason that I had to decide to give the lectures twice running, the first time every day at 10 a.m., and then again, especially for those members who wish to hear it in the English translation, at 11 o'clock. For technical reasons, this is the only way. Therefore, I shall begin each first lecture punctually at 10, and the repeat lecture at 11 o'clock. I should like to ask those of you present who have come from England, Holland, and Scandinavia to attend the repeat lectures, and the others to go to the first one." Only the repeat lectures were taken down in shorthand. Each lecture was given in two or three parts, after each of which there followed the English translation given by George Kaufman. And that is the end of the book, Soul Economy and Waldorf Education by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Roland Everett, Collected Works, Volume 303.